Welcome to the Working Dog Depot podcast with your hosts, Rich Harden and Howard Young.
All right. Hey, Howard Young. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing well. Recovering from this Thanksgiving break.
Yeah,
we had a break for you, but
we did not have Thanksgiving. We had a new grandbaby born. Had dogs that I couldn't get anybody to watch, so they're here at my house, and you know, so we just worked. But no worries, it's all good. And it's a rainy, cold night in the state of Kentucky. So
yeah, it's starting to rain here too. So tonight we have a gentleman that I have known for a pretty good while. And he's very well known in the police dog community, among other communities. So he's an author, podcaster, vendor, educator. And that's not even touching on what he's done in terms of the sport world and the police dog venues. I would like to introduce Jerry Bradshaw.
Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me on. I appreciate it.
I really appreciate your willingness to do this. When I asked you, I thought, he's going to be too busy, but you were really receptive. I appreciate that.
Hey, anytime for you, Howard. You are you're one of the good guys in the dog business I've known for a really long time, and so I'm happy to be able to come on and help.
Well, I appreciate that very much.
Well, thank you.
I feel like, go ahead, Rich.
No, I just said thanks a lot. You know, it's people. You know, when people do podcasts or, you know, you ask people to come on and take their time. So, you know, we like to be respectful of people's time, and we really appreciate you just, you know, making the time to speak with us.
Absolutely.
Well, it's nice when it goes forward without any glitches. This was about as easy as it gets. We've had some situations where we just couldn't all get on the same page, and this kind of came together nicely. I want to go down memory lane a little bit before we get too far into this, is that I'm pretty sure, and we've never had this discussion, but I'm pretty sure I was in attendance of your first Schutzen trial.
I know after I was recently at the airport wearing a Working Dog shirt, and your son and daughter-in-law were just happened to be sitting across from me. I've been traveling so much, I can't even remember where I was going.
Nashville.
Nashville, right. It was Nashville. So I was going to do a PSA seminar that weekend, and your son asked me a question. He said, are you into working dogs? And I thought it was going to be one of those, you know, conversations with a civilian, you know what I mean? Going to ask me, well, how long does it take to train a police dog questions? And so I sort of dutifully replied. And then he told me that he was your son. And I was like, so then we started having a little bit of a chat. And then later on, we had talked about potentially me coming on, you and I did. And you had mentioned that to me. And I had no idea, because we actually haven't ever talked about it.
I've been trying to put together the year, and I'm thinking, and I may be wrong, but I think it's between 92 and 94.
Yeah, I think it might have been a little closer to 92. I'm pretty sure it was around then.
And so it was cold, and it was in Raleigh.
It was like there was an ice storm.
Yes, there was.
That day. Yeah, because yes. I was in Sanford, and I was freaking out about how I was going to get my. I had an old van that I had bought. It was like a Econoline 350, but it was from years and years ago. Right. And to give you an idea of how much of a trash heap this thing was, and you know those things are not good in the snow. Definitely not good on ice. And it was my first Schutzen trial, and I was waking up in Sanford, and I knew I had to get up to North Raleigh to where the Schutzen Club was. And it was just this old. When I bought the van, it had a hole in the floor, and it didn't have a shifter on the steering wheel. It had just a rod going through the hole in the floor into the transmission, and you had to like hook it up and down to like change the gears on it. And I remember getting up there, and we had a couple of close calls, like almost sliding off the road. And then, it's actually a funny story, because the first thing we did there was track. And I had this dog that was, his name was Ben. He was one of my first dogs. And I was showing him. And he was such a project in the tracking. You know, he came to me and he didn't want to track. And I spent so much time, I was neglecting my dissertation because I was at UNC at the time trying to finish my PhD in economics. And I was neglecting writing my dissertation to go tracking with him as many times a day as I could. I was fascinated by trying to like work on this problem. And there was, when we get to, we had to go actually all the way to Lewisburg to where the tracking fields were at the airport up there. I don't know if you know that airport, but it's where they usually have like people would like jump out of the planes and parachutes and all that sort of stuff. So we would often go up there as a club and track there because Floyd Wilson, who is the training director, you probably know Floyd, right? Yep. I had known Floyd. You know, he had a connection there at the airport. So anyway, long story short, I'm sliding in and out off the road, like trying to get up there. We get up there and there is this like sheet of like hail and snow and just like a dusting covering the tracking grounds. And it was a miracle. We end up with like a 92 on the track and he was like doing a 100 point track. And it was only because he was just completely visually tracking. Like he could see the footsteps in the snow. And I knew this, right? I, you know, because whenever I tracked him in dirt, he was like a 100 point tracker, but he was a disaster on grass. And so, you know, sort of God blessed me with a really easy track that morning. And that was my first competition track ever. And we ended up with a 92. It was, you know, then we were on to obedience and the bite work, which was the bite work was his special area. But yeah, that was a crazy trial weekend. And to hear that you were actually there at the Raleigh trial was when we actually came back to Raleigh and went to our club. That is so funny that it's a small world, right? Like
it really
like,
is.
Who would have thought I would meet your son and daughter-in-law at the airport? And then, to find out later that you were at my first Schutzen trial is kind of funny.
Yeah, it is funny. I was talking to my mom just yesterday. I was trying to figure out why I went. And I think, because we're a good 3 hours or 3 hours, 15 minutes or so from Raleigh. I think I went specifically to attend that trial.
Yeah.
I was very into Schutzen at that time. We had a little DVG club locally, but it was an opportunity to see a trial in North Carolina, and I went, and I almost didn't go, obviously, because of the weather, but
right.
it was sketchy. There were patches of ice on the interstate.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a little crazy.
Very cool. You guys actually were on the same flight on the way back from Nashville. So again, another weird set of circumstances. Hunter said that they just about saved the seat next to them. And then he actually said he probably saved you some peace and quiet on the way home because Molly, she would have talked your ear off.
That's funny. Super nice people. They're very nice to meet.
Well, thank you. I'm proud of both of them. They're very engaging, obviously, to see someone they didn't know in an airport and start a conversation. Yeah.
Well, funny. It's dog shirt, right? Dogs always bring together a conversation.
Absolutely.
You know? Absolutely.
A great icebreaker, no matter where you're at, right? It's always interesting how those conversations go.
Yeah, for sure. And, to have somebody comment on my shirt doesn't happen too often. It was just a PSA club from Kansas. I was wearing that. I just happened to be wearing their club shirt that morning when I was flying out.
So I guess I'll steal Rich's question. He generally asks how you got started in all this. And it's really funny. I feel like our paths in many respects have some real interesting similarities from the educational piece to, but I feel like you dove in with both feet. I feel like I always have played it safe. You kind of jumped in with both feet and you've been a real mover and shaker.
Yeah. It's kind of an interesting story going from the academic world to dog training. But yeah, I mean, I touched on it a little bit in telling that story. I kind of, you know, it all began when I was, living in Chapel Hill. I was minding my own business, being a good academic student, being a PhD student there. And somebody tried to break into my house and I ended up going to the shelter. And as a good academic, I did so much research, right? I bought the AKC breed book. I'm trying to figure out like what dog I want to get. And the funny thing is, and I haven't told too many people this story, but I was dead set on getting a boxer. And it was mainly because of the picture in the AKC breed book was this boxer that was like all muscular and it was perched on this rock and it looked really, and the description said they were a good guarding breed and all that sort of stuff. And yeah, so, but I was trying to like call around and find some place where I could get a boxer, and it was actually a lot more difficult than, you know, than I thought. And I end up talking to this guy who had this breeding in Canada, and long story short, I end up getting buying a Malinois puppy. And he was a good breeder because he told me, he said, look, I'm sympathetic with your situation. He said, you're a smart guy because you're obviously in graduate school. But he's like, you got to do a few things. Number one, you got to get Stuart Hilliard's book on Schutzen. And then funny thing is he became a friend and a mentor. I had him out to Tar Heel a couple times. I was just at Lackland last November doing a seminar there for his breeding program folks, his trainers there, and some of the trainers in the military working dog program. And so we've stayed friends for a really long time, but I only knew about him because this breeder had told me about this book, Schutzen Theory and Practice. And I just dove into that, you know, having this puppy. And then he also told me it was mandatory for me to find a Schutzen club, and I had no idea what that was. And so, you know, I started looking up Schutzen and what it was all about. And it just so happened that shortly after I got this puppy, the Schutzen Nationals was in Northern Virginia. And so I ended up calling the USA office and asking some questions. I didn't know who I was talking to. I didn't, you know anything really. And, you know, I just remember the secretary at the USA office said, well, you're going to really love going to this trial. You're going to see the best trainers from across the country and all that. And I packed up my giant VCR camcorder. You remember the... Mm-hmm. Right. Like the ones that you carry on your back, basically on your shoulder. I went up there and I just remember like watching all these handlers come out with these dogs. And it was kind of an ominous trial because it was very foggy and cool. And, you know, it was like a really cool fall day in Northern Virginia. It was very foggy. I remember that. And you would just see these handlers come out from, you know, come onto the field and come out of the fog, and you know, with all this beautiful healing and the dogs under control, and then, you know, then going to the protection work. And I was like hooked from seeing that first picture. But I always tell people, like, my first picture of what these dogs looked like wasn't just some club in the middle of nowhere, you know what I mean, that was a like a bad, you know, a bad club, or, you know, didn't have very experienced trainers. I'm watching the cream of the crop of the whole organization, you know, like the top 50 or 60 people, you know, that were out there showing. And, you know, and then when I came back to came back to Sanford, or actually Chapel Hill, I was living there at the time. When I came back to Chapel Hill, I'm like, I am looking for a Schutzen club, and I find the Raleigh Club, and it's full of great trainers, right? So yeah. Floyd Wilson and Ralph Hunt, who you know, was in that club. He was the main helper in the club next to Floyd, and he's a lawyer now in Durham. And after like 20 years, he stopped in my place down in Sanford, and we kind of got reacquainted. They ended up getting back into dogs, and I sold him a couple of dogs for him and his wife Anita to train. They're both lawyers there. And so like that connection of having a great club and my first picture of the sport being these really, really highly well-trained dogs, you know, I think that I always tell people that it was good luck. You know, I was just like lucky, lucky to be in a good place at a good time, you know, and have my first picture of all that, you know, be something that I really wanted to like live up to. And so, you know, that was my beginning, and the people in that club really sort of shaped my understanding of sport work and, you know, good training and good dogs. And so that was really a blessing for me to have those opportunities early on in my career.
Well, how did that experience shape your PhD?
Well, I ended up having to leave because I wasn't getting any work done. So I was a little disaffected with the whole process there at UNC. I loved the school. You know, I actually, a lot of my professors were great, but I didn't really care for the hazing that went on at the upper levels in a PhD program, because I had already been through a master's program at Virginia Tech, and I had published a couple of papers out of my master's thesis, and it was a, you know, I went through an agricultural economics department first. It was mostly applied economics that I was doing there. And I was actually in my master's program, I was treated more like a colleague than I was in the PhD program. There was a lot more hazing at UNC. It was, you know, it was a higher ranked program. And so it is what it is. And I went to my PhD, you know, they have like a proposal defense that you have to do before you're allowed to carry on and finish out your research, right? So you have all your committee members in the same room. And I had already decided that I was going to do something else by the time my proposal defense came around. But I don't know if I just really wanted to like tell them off. And, you know, and I kind of did that. I pretty much surprised them by not defending my proposal. I basically told them how I didn't like the process and that I was leaving, and they're mostly a little confused. They offered me to give me a master's degree, but then my major professor said, well, you already have one of those, so I guess that doesn't really matter. And I said, yeah, I just really want to start another chapter of my life. And I had already kind of decided I was going to start a little dog training business at that time, because I was already training, you know, dogs for my hobby. And yeah, everybody thought I was nuts. My family thought I was crazy. I literally walked out and left everything as it was, my office. I had, you know, cabinets full of journal articles that I had photocopied that I was working with, and books. And I just gave all that to the graduate students that were still there that were on my floor, and my office mate. And I kind of like let him know what was happening. And yeah, I walked away and just started a different life. And I am eternally grateful that I had the courage to step away from that. Things turned out pretty well, I feel like, in my second career. But I also, as I also tell my students oftentimes, I really feel like it was a blessing to have that academic background. It taught me a lot about how to do research, how to think about things, how to like enter. I don't know who it was that originally said this. You'll probably know, Howard, but you know, like the ability to entertain an idea without becoming married to it, you know, as just a, you know, as just an idea. I think it might've been Aristotle who said that, but I really feel like my ability to analyze things and think about, you know, sort of how things come together, you know, just as an academic, really makes it, you know, a lot easier for me to teach concepts, to be able to think through problems, to think of solutions to problems when I'm looking at, you know, when I'm looking at dogs. And that, you know, like my whole goal in life had been to become a college professor and a teacher. And I feel like I've still been able to retain that goal. It's just a different subject matter that I've been teaching. And so that, you know, in that way, I feel like I didn't completely abandon my former life. And I've leveraged a lot of that in, you know, my work, in my teaching, in my podcast, and all of that stuff. So I feel like that academic background was in many ways like a huge blessing to be able to, you know, sort of allow me to do what I do in the way that I do it, I guess.
Well, don't you think, you know, to follow up with what you're saying, don't you think the transference of information to your clients is the most important thing we do as a dog trainer? Because it doesn't matter how good you are with the dog, you know.
Yeah, that's very true.
You have two great trainers, you know, but yeah, if you can't teach your client how to do it, then really it doesn't matter.
Hey, folks, we're proud to have Hold the Line Canine Conference as a supporter and sponsor of the Working Dog Depot podcast. Joe Lukowski and staff are already securing vendors and presenters for the seminar in April. That's April 9th, 10th, and 11th in a brand new location. That's right, Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. We are especially excited about that. It's going to cut our travel time in half, and there's nothing like being in the Carolinas in early April. And that's Hold the Line Canine Conference. We're very much looking forward to being there and hope to see you all there. Thank you.
Yeah, I think that's a huge part of it, right? Like, you know, I tell my students also that I've met a lot of really great dog trainers. I call them like intuitive dog trainers. You can put a dog in their hands and they can work magic. But it really is a unique skill to be able to take that and be able to break it down and communicate it to somebody else on a level that they can process and understand, and to be able to communicate it in a number of different ways without getting frustrated at your student who is not understanding what you're saying. And I, I think when I, you know, and Howard, I'm sure you can echo this, is when I first got into the police dog world, you know, there are a lot of people who are looked up to as master trainers or whatever the case may be. And then you see them in action and you're like, they're basically just yelling things at people. They're really not doing a whole lot of teaching. And just because you have experience doesn't mean you're good at passing information along to anybody. And that is a skill I feel like people have to develop over time and get good at. I think that's a big problem in our space, where there are a lot of people out there doing teaching that actually have no business teaching anyone anything. You know, they get a little bit of information after 15 minutes of Instagram fame, and suddenly they're teaching without any perspective.
The parents of the dog world.
Yeah, there are people out there that are, you know, teaching people how to work and train police dogs that have never finished a police dog in their life. You know, and I think that's a big problem in our industry, where people kind of get catapulted to fame, you know, based on, you know, social media and that sort of thing. And, you know, they really don't have a lot of perspective to offer on things, where, you know, they can teach a seminar and go into depth in certain areas where there are other people that have been around for a while that really are thoughtful about the information that they have developed and are able to teach it, and can offer some perspective to people, whether they're, you know, like, I feel like when I walk into a seminar, if I've got a trainer that's in there that's been training for 15 or 20 years and a handler that's been just on the dog for like a year or two, I can talk to both of them. And, you know, I feel like that's, you know, sort of in part, I kept my mouth shut for probably the first 12 or 13 years that I was training dogs, and just went about my business of doing it, and really didn't try and put myself out there in any way until I felt like I really had some experience to be able to say something meaningful. But also, I feel like my academic background helped me be able to analyze things and to be able to communicate them in such a way that people can understand it and can appreciate it on a bunch of different levels, right?
I think, you know, I felt like I pretty much did the same thing. I know that I kept my head down and just did my thing in my community, maybe even more isolated than you. Like I said, I really feel like you jumped in with both feet, and I commend you for that. I maintained a full-time position up until 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the other stuff, the police dog stuff has always been kind of part-time. But there are several interesting, I think we did not have the allure. Well, obviously we didn't have the allure of social media. So it was a much easier back then to just keep your head down and do your thing and not worry about attention.
Mm,
I think a lot of folks are worried about trying to be relevant or become relevant.
Mm-hmm.
And so much is lost in trying to do that. And you touched on so many things that really resonate with me. The other being, I would call it differentiated instruction, where you have to be patient and you have to figure out what particular ways people learn. You know, some are kinesthetic, some are auditory, some simply, you know, they need to have things modeled. Mm-hmm. And I like to do those things, and the guys that I'm working with probably aren't even aware that that's taking place.
Right.
So, some of the other guys get frustrated. They'll say, why don't you just tell him to shut up? And it's kind of like, well, one of the things that I recognized about one particular guy is that the way he processes information is that he says it out loud.
Right.
So he starts telling me what the dog's thinking. Well, he doesn't need to tell me what the dog's thinking, but that's how he's learning.
Mm-hmm.
That's how he's picking up what's going on.
Yeah.
Now, it can be frustrating to listen to.
Sounds like a therapy session.
It does.
But you had to pick those things up, though, in order to get your point across. Because if not, it's lost in the sauce for him. You know?
For sure.
If you don't give him that opportunity to give that feedback, then he doesn't, like you said, he doesn't process that information at all. And now he's back and he's looking at you like you got three heads again.
Yeah. Well, and it's a kid that has experienced a lot of success in his life. I mean, he's a go-getter. He's athletic. Things have come easy to him, and And when you see him getting frustrated, you've got to be super patient because mm-hmm. right. he's ready to throw it all in because it's not working. Well, yeah. it is working. It's just not working on your timetable.
Right.
I wanted to touch on a subject. I'm gonna catch Rich off guard a little bit on this one, but I want to talk about the term capping because I okay. feel like you can explain that term. So I'm gonna tell on Rich a little bit. He tells this story about how when he was working with the Navy dogs that he got an opportunity to go to a seminar and at the seminar the instructor used this term capping, but as he described it, Rich in his way says that's obedience. That's mm-hmm. simply obedience. Am I right about that, Rich?
You are absolutely right.
That was your take on that. So the guy was not really able to differentiate between what is capping versus what is managing behavior through obedience. Mm. Can you touch on that?
Well, I think there's a certain amount of managing behavior through obedience that is capping, right? So if the idea for me, and I try and explain this in a way that's a little bit visual, is, you know, imagine you have a high drive dog. So that's, you know, I got a teapot on the stove and it's boiling and, you know, the top is off the teapot and all the steam is coming out. And the idea with capping is, you know, I want to take all of that drive expression and I want to temporarily pause it, right? So I put the top with the obedience, I put the top on the teapot. Everything is still boiling on the inside, right? Nothing is coming out. And that would be, let's say, you know, you have a dog you're bringing up to do a building search and he's all excited. He's reading the signs that say, we're about to go do something, right? So, you know, we bring the dog into the building and he wants to get expressive and maybe bark and, you know, because we're kind of bringing him up slowly and he's not getting to do it immediately. So he's feeling a little frustration. He's starting to express a little bit. And then, boom, we give him that command down. And then he goes into that down and he stays quiet, right? So the idea is we take that expressiveness and through obedience, we're able to harness it all. And it's still boiling in there. He still wants to let it all out. But he's giving us the obedience that we want in that situation without what we would call leaking, right? So the teapot example extends to the leaking, right? So, you know, we don't want that dog or bark, bark while he's in the down, right? Like, so the idea of capping is to show him it's in his interest to hold all that inside until we release it by giving him the search command. And then that gets released in a way that's more productive. It's released not in vocalizing. It's released, you know, not in sort of anxious behavior. It's released in a way where the dog puts all that energy into the searching and the goal-directed behavior of finding somebody in the building. And so capping is a sort of a temporary thing, you know, and then we have the extension of that, which we call neutrality, which is when the dog gets into a lower arousal state in general, when they would come into a situation like that. And, you know, like extended capping and, you know, kind of like rewarding the dog for holding obedience in those situations, holding that down, you know, prior to be asked to search will naturally lead to lower arousal levels in general if you work on that, right? And you bleed off some of that energy with like toy play or, you know, kind of reward the dog with, you know, food reward or something like that. And, you know, I was just at a seminar in Southern California and there are a lot of, you know, really powerful, strong dogs. Some of them came over here older, you know, like at 2.5 years old. They've been in KNPV programs, you know, where they don't really care about drive leaking or anything like that. You know, if they're yelling "Halt, Polizzi, Halt, Polizzi," and the dog is, you know, rah, 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 we're going bananas in heel position. As long as he doesn't break before he's sent, he's all good. So you get these dogs that have all this power, all this outward expression, and now they want to make him into a SWAT dog and they want to, you know, make that dog quiet in all these situations. And then oftentimes what happens is what gets mistaked for drive capping, where we're actually managing how we reward the dog in that cap state so we can actually get the behavior that we want without suppressing him, is people just suppressing the dog. So they bring him up and it's just like, you know, knock his dick in the dirt while he's in that down until he just shuts up. Strangle the hell out of him with a dominant dog collar until he just shuts up, and then wait for him to be quiet and send him. And that's probably the most naive and foolish way to go about drive capping, because what you actually can do with young dogs when you do that to them is you can cross over the line from operant conditioning into classical conditioning. The dog says, I really hate coming up to do building searches because I'm all enthusiastic about it, and now I just get the shit kicked out of me to be quiet. And I can't be quiet. I don't know how to be quiet. Nobody's ever taught me how to be quiet. Nobody's ever showed me that it's in my self-interest to be quiet. And that's kind of what we do when we work on drive capping, is to show the dog by leveraging the reward system that we're using to teach the dog that it's in his interest to get quiet. It's in his interest to lay down, hold it all in, and then we can, you know, work on things like duration and stuff like that with them, knowing that in drive capping, if we're going to ask for a lot of extended quiet, you know, maybe if we got like a dog on a perimeter or in a SWAT exercise or, a warrant service or something like that, then we need to be able to do more extended work with that dog. And that usually morphs over into what we call neutrality, which is, you know, we can get the dog in a lower arousal state around the things that usually create a high arousal expressive state. And so, you know, this is what we do in PSA all the time. Like, you know, it's almost like people think that drive capping was invented like in the police dog world in the last couple of years when everybody started, you know, taking on the SWAT paradigm of we want quiet dogs in the building search. Although I must say that when I go to seminars, I still have a lot of departments that they want the best of both worlds for their patrol dogs, right? Like, mm-hmm. I like to be able to have a patrol dog that's noisy when I want him to be. If I want to point him at somebody and tell him, you know, to alert on that guy and show him what it means to look nasty, and this is what you're going to get if you don't show me some hands, I want that option, but I want the option to also control it. And what most drive capping is reduced to, it's very reductive nowadays, it's just reduced to be quiet all the time. And then when you want that, where I say, well, now I want him to be expressive. I want him to bark. I want him to go bananas a little bit until I tell him to shut up again. They don't have that capability because all they've done is suppress the dog when he's noisy. And so to me, drive capping is about also having expression, also allowing that dog to get rewarded for that expression, and then teaching him, hey, if you turn it off, right, there's also a reward in you for that too. So on command, put it in, you know, put the cover on the teapot for a little while, and there's going to be a reward that you're going to get from that, right? But also I may reward you for being expressive at times and be able to show that expression, be able to, you know, bark at a potential threat when I need you to. And so that's kind of like my argument with what I see a lot of people doing when they're working young dogs, and what they're doing is they're just teaching them to be quiet all the time. And then when you want to get the dog in the right headspace to maybe do something that's out of their home zone a little bit, like they can't call on all that energy that comes from an alert behavior where they're like coming up and directing their focus on something and being expressive about it. And then like sometimes you're like, does this dog even paying attention to what I'm trying to point him at? Does he really understand what the threat is in this situation? Because I can't get him into that expressive state because, like I said, he's been encouraged since he was very young, or maybe a green dog, to always be quiet. And so I don't do that with our young dogs. We, you know, when we start bringing young dogs in, I want them to be able to be expressive on a cue, but I also will later teach them to be quiet on a cue. And so that gives me the best of both worlds, I feel like. And, you know, and I guess, you know, again, you got a lot of people out there teaching classes and doing decoy work that have never actually trained a dog to be able to do both, right? Mm-hmm. They don't really understand how do I preserve that expression when I also want to work on that capping and get that behavior as well. Also, like a lot of people don't understand, you got to reward the dog for capping. If all you do is punish the expressiveness, right, it's going to be fairly inconsistent at times, and you're not going to get a really good result, right? Like how many behaviors, you know, if quiet is the opposite of expressive, you know, just punishing expressive is not going to get you a good quiet that you can get from actually rewarding quiet well. And then we don't always have to reward quiet with a decoy, with a bite, right? We don't always have to spin the dog up and think that that's the answer. You know, using lower value rewards and training reward, you know, this can unroll into a conversation that goes deep into how police departments and trainers are teaching obedience. And, you know, are they working neutrality work and obedience? Like you see a lot of, you know, I think more progressive departments are teaching the dogs the same shit that we as sport dog people have been telling them to, you know, that's possible to do for years. And now they're coming around to it. That, you know, they think it's their idea to do.
Right. Like, well, be careful. You teach obedience, you'll diminish their drive, right?
Right, right. And that's the thing is, but that is true if you teach obedience poorly, right? If your obedience is suppressive in nature, if your obedience centers around, you know, constant like nagging and correction and negative reinforcement and pressure, right? It can it actually does make it worse, right? So there are many times in the beginning when I first started doing police dogs where, you know, I realized we had to lay off a lot of obedience because as soon as I put the damn dog in a handler's hand and he goes back to his in-service program, back at his department, it's like, what's all this about tugs and food? And that's bullshit. So now we're going to, you know, just fuck, show him his boss, right? Roll him over, do the alpha roll. Like, it's like 1930 called and, you know, wants their fucking training back. And some of these people are stuck in that mindset, you know?
I still
get surprised by it sometimes where I feel like maybe I'm going to an area that's way more progressive out of this stuff. And there's still those ideas. Like there's these, you know, for some people, you know, there's still these, you know, like, I want to say old wives' tales, but I don't want to diminish older wives. You know what I mean? Like, it's more like old trainer tales where it's like, the dog won't bite for real anymore if you make him be obedient. It's like, are you fucking kidding? Like, this is what gets taught and passed down in these stone tablets from these trainers to these young guys that are just coming on the unit. And they're like, I don't fucking know any better. Nobody's ever told me anything different. So I guess this is the truth. So that kind of stuff drives me a little bit crazy. But on the plus side, I've really seen a lot of more progressive attitudes toward training good obedience, right? And then, you know, like with a lot of these guys or the past seminar that I did in Southern California, right? Superpower dogs, a lot of them were pretty leaky. So I told them, I'm like, how long does it take you when you get to a call to actually release your dog? And they're like, oh, a lot of time. Like we got to knock on doors. We got to put drones up. We got to give, you know, like announcements in 17 different languages. And, you know, by the time they actually do the yard-to-yard searches, that dog has been hanging out anticipating this for a really long time. So I'm like, get them out, do some obedience, bleed off some of that drive, you know, work on your long downs, like pay them with lower value rewards. And like, this is all news to a lot of these guys, you know, and it's like, don't tell anybody, but this is like sport training stuff. Like, you know what I mean? Like, don't, you know, we don't have to speak the dirty word, you know, that five letter word, sport, right? And, but the reality is we're all trying to manipulate drives. I all want my dog to go into a search clear headed. I was talking to a gentleman from a department on the East Coast today doing a Zoom lesson, you know, and he's talking about how his dog, you know, when they're on their way to calls, the dog is figuring out, hey, we're leaving the highway, we're taking a row, we're going to, you know, heading out to a convenience store, and then everybody else is showing up, and the dog is getting all spun up in the back of the car. And he's like, I've just started, like, you know, putting him in a down and throwing kibble back there and like trying to get him to relax a little bit before all this happens, and then get him out and with a little bit of a lower state of drive. And try and like reward him for doing other tasks in between that searching task and not just let him, you know, pull me to the building or pull me to the area where we're going to do the area search. And I think, you know, I think it's slow coming. You know, maybe in my, you know, before I retire, I'll see, you know, more departments doing that kind of more progressive stuff. But I think we got to get rid of the stigma on well-trained obedience. So like when people post shit on social media and saying like, oh, you can have both, you can have obedience and you can have drive. It's like, well, I want to qualify that, right? Like you got to be able to train obedience well. And there's not a lot of people that train obedience well. Who trains obedience the best of trainers in America and Europe? Sport trainers do. Learn from them, right? Like, go outside your department. Like, half the time when I'm trying to book a seminar in certain places, you know, the first thing that the, you know, the unit commander asks is, well, is he a cop? I'm like, what the fuck does that have to do with training obedience? In fact, I have been able to specialize in training sport obedience, right? And put, I'm not out there doing domestic calls. I'm not writing reports. I can put my free time into learning new stuff, right? So like, leverage your expert level of people who really know how to do this stuff. Call them in and bring them in, right? And I feel like, at least for me, I've crossed the barrier between sport and police dogs pretty well, you know. And I invented with Joe Morris, I invented a sport that actually uses a lot of the same things. Like, you know, we have civil bites in our sport. We have unsuited muzzle attacks in our sport, you know, things that you don't see in other sports, you know, sleeve sports and that sort of thing. And, you know, we've got some really great trainers that compete in PSA that are capable of doing these things, right? And I feel like, you know, we've got a level of expertise in blending obedience and maximizing drive and creating clear-headedness, because if we don't, we don't win. And I want to go out and win. I want to win nationals in the level three. And that's my main goal in life when I'm training a sport dog. And for these guys, you know, they're out there with their dogs. I want their dogs to be quiet. I want their dogs to be able to bark when they want them to and quiet when they want them to. I want them to have everything. Right. I want to show them the way that they can have everything. And I think it all really boils down to creating a lot of clear headedness through obedience, through drive capping, things of that nature that are still kind of gaining acceptance in the wider police dog world, I think.
Mm-hmm. Those are really, really good points. We actually had a gentleman, I had somebody, and this happens quite often, actually, where somebody will contact me through social media and say, hey, I'm a decoy. I decoy for sport. Whatever the sport may be, how do you feel about me coming and decoying for your police group? Absolutely. I'm all in. I want them to come. One, it gives me a break because I'm an old man and can't do it. And the other is the other guys aren't chomping at the bit to do it. So you get somebody that's young and passionate about doing it, and they know what behaviors to mark. They know what we're looking for. And so this guy came and he brought his dog with him, and he's at least PSA one. Is a really, and I can't remember the gentleman's name, but he decoyed for us. And then at the very end, I said, well, get your dog and bring him in and just kind of show the guys. And they were blown away, but they're, mm-hmm. and they're saying my dog won't, they're all saying my dog won't do that. And right. They're right in one respect, their dog won't do that given their current skill set and their level of commitment. Therein lies the big difference. So I was going to ask you, because because you're so ingrained in both worlds, because you are training police dogs at your facility and what's possible on the other end, mm-hmm. you can't, in your period of time that you have allotted, you can't get them anywhere near that level of the sport dog. How do you grapple with that?
Hey, folks, we're excited to tell you about one of our new sponsors. That's Ray Allen Manufacturing. Ray Allen has been making canine-related products since 1948. Many of you recognize the name Ray Allen with being synonymous with quality canine gear. Both Rich and I have been ordering equipment from them for years. My now adult sons have shared with me that some of their childhood memories involved seeing Ray Allen catalogs at home. That's right, folks, catalogs that came in the mail before the internet. Over the past few years, we've gotten to know some of the faces behind the scenes and have come to appreciate them for who they are. We've also enjoyed the banter back and forth. I've been the subject of at least one prank. It's relationships like these that are icing on top of the cake when it comes to doing business with a company. When searching for canine-related gear, seek out a trusted name in the industry. That's Ray Allen Manufacturing. For a 10% discount, use the WDD10 discount code. Thank you.
It's tough, right? Like, you know, we're on tighter deadlines when we're dealing with police dogs and so forth. You know, the expectation in the industry is, you know, to, you know, churn a dog out in something less than 6 months, right? Like we do now, we've gotten to the point now where we do like a four-month train up. And then, you know, we're dealing with a lot of smaller and medium-sized departments that don't have full staff trainers. And so they're coming and going through, you know, 4 weeks of handler course with a trained dog. And, you know, there's only so much information you can impart there in a short period of time. Some of our, like some of my favorite departments are the ones that like send their guys through that handler course, take them back home, and then they spend another like 2 months FTOing them. Or they put them through a longer handler course, you know, when they get back home. They've got trainers on staff to do that. And I love when that happens because I really feel like then the handlers can take that dog back home, spend a little extra time, you know, learning the ropes of what it is to be a canine handler in that area under the guidance of their, you know, senior staff. But, you know, a lot of guys finish up with us on a Friday, you know, and they're back, they're at work with that dog Monday morning, you know, and, you know, it's tough for some of those smaller departments to be able to manage all that stuff. But yeah, I think in terms of, you know, the train up, there are lots of what I call quick and dirty ways to get, you know, an attention heel, get through the drive capping to where we're doing, you know, down and route with them, call offs and all that sort of stuff. So they don't need all the skills of, you know, let's say a PSA 1 or a PSA 2 dog by any means. They do, you know, I feel like getting some neutrality in those dogs, where the neutrality matters in the police dog, honestly, Howard, is in the backup neutrality, right? Like, you know, you want to train a dog that wants to go out there and bite somebody for real. That means that anybody is a potential target for that dog, right? So they're not discriminating just on people in bite suits. And then, so if you do that well, then, you know, you got, you know, guys that are, you know, coming up and being backup for them when they're deploying in a real life situation. You know, maybe it's a guy in a plain clothes and he's from a gang unit or something like that. And they're not all wearing kit. They're not all wearing uniforms. And, you know, teach them, hey, whatever's behind you is don't bite that and just go out, you know, and bite what's in front of you for the most part. If you can get that done in, you know, a basic patrol dog, I feel like you've done a lot, right? Like in terms of neutrality, like that. That's a good place to start for them, right? The problem is, and I say this with every seminar I go to and with all our canine handlers, is where do you go from there, right? Like Sean Siggins, who used to be my handler course instructor, and I used to talk about this all the time, and he would say, look, you know, like I do their research after a year sometimes, and the, you know, you get those dogs and handlers where the best day they ever had was the last day of the handler course. And then you get others where you send them home and you know the in-service work is good and, you know, like they've got good supervision, they've got good training, and they come back the next year and you're like, you know, man, they are better than they were the last day of the handler course. And that's what we all want to see, right? That's what I always tell, you know, the clients that are leaving is like when you come back, if you come back for a seminar, you come back, you know, for a research or something like that, like, by God, I want you to be better than the day you left. And, right. You know, when they're not, that pisses me off, right? It's like, okay, well, you know, you haven't been, you know, advancing your dog. And this is another thing that, you know, that comes up for me all the time, which is why are we not showing these guys, you know, where are the goals for them, right? Like, so I say sport goals and sport work is super easy compared to police work, right? So I was telling these guys at the seminar, I'm like, I'm going to tell you a secret. It's easy for me to set goals as a sport guy because you know what I do? I look in the rule book after I finish my level one and it tells me all the things in the level two I got to prepare for mostly. There are some surprise scenarios. There's going to be stuff that's put together in a different order, right? But the reality is, you know, the sport's going to tell me what I got to start preparing for. And you guys, you don't have that, right? Like you have to set goals for yourself. You got to ask yourself, you know, like with some of these dogs, we were working on like hand signal targeting or casting your dog, you know, capping, you know, comes into like, all right, let's say I send my dog on a yard to yard search and I see him, he's stuck in a corner for some reason, right? He's in a scent pool or something like that, but he hasn't searched this other side of the yard and I want to bring him over there, right? So, hey, maybe I can teach him a targeting system with a laser. Well, what if it's daytime? Well, maybe I can teach him a targeting system where I can cap him in the midst of the search and he looks at me and I can give him a hand signal to move and search the other side of the yard, right? You know, we do that in some of our advanced work with some of our seminars when we do high risk deployment stuff and, you know, and street readiness seminars. And, you know, and so, but the idea is, let's set some goals. Like, I don't expect you to have all of that stuff like the day you graduate the handler course, right? But start thinking to yourself, hey, I want to, you know, I want my research the next year to be piece of cake. I want to set these goals in terms of how I can target my dog on threats in an operational way that's safe for the dog and safe for my backup people, right? So maybe we teach them a laser targeting to help with that. But like this whole idea of being able to move a dog around in space and not be at the mercy of where they think they should go, right? We had this area search in Southern California. It was a perfect. It was this guy's home. He was an older man, and he was like super pro law enforcement, you know, horse guy. So he had animal experience. And, you know, he told Darcy Hall, who is the person that put on the seminar at her place called Hope Canine there. And he knew Darcy for a lot of years. And he's like, I've got this house. I'm getting ready to rent out. It's getting ready to be fixed up. But you can have the house and the yard. It was perfect. It was a nice house for a residential building surge. And then we had this beautiful yard in the back, and it had a horse trailer and a pickup truck and, you know, just a bunch of things out there, right? And a lot of the dogs went in, and all they did was they got stuck on the side of the yard where the horse trailers were, where the car was, or they were searching around the objects, right? And then we had a lot of brush on the other side, and some of the dogs had a hard time being able to be controlled while they're out searching. And so that's where I was able to debrief them and say, look, make some of your goals for next year to be, I can cap my dog. So he's in the midst of searching, right? And I say, sit. And he turns around and looks at me like a bird dog. And I say, you know, left. And he goes over to his left and starts searching the other side of the yard, right? Those are things that you can build into what you're going to do next, right? Set some goals. Ask yourself what kinds of things do you want your dog to be able to do? And I think that's a big problem is we oftentimes focus so much on the research and the certification. And, you know, maybe if we're a good training group and we're focusing on, let's say, you know, scenario type training, you know, we're like, oh, we had a deployment, dog struggled. How do we break it down? How do we train this particular deployment? You know, break that down into pieces that you can share with other people to where they say, these are some goals I want to have this year. And what about in your dog's third year? What goals do you want to have in your third year? What goals do you want to have in your fourth year, right? How much different is your dog in its third year to its fifth year, right? And maybe it's just status quo. You know, the dog
still doesn't out. Still doesn't out.
Still doesn't out, right? Exactly, right? You know, well, there's that old wives' tale that if your dog outs real easy, you won't bite somebody for real, Howard. I don't know what to do about that, right?
Let me tell you about our newest sponsor, Gold Coast Canine. Gold Coast 20-acre modern canine training facility is located in sunny Southern California and was established in 1991. Gold Coast owner Rodney Spicer was bitten by the Schutzen bug in the mid-80s, and by the year 2000, he tutored over 20 different dogs in a variety of working dog sports, from Schutzen to protection sports. This led him to eventually work with police dogs and began selling them to vendors. In the mid-90s, Gold Coast began selling dogs directly to police agencies. To date, Gold Coast supplies dogs to over 100 law enforcement agencies and provides training to 27 agencies for regularly scheduled maintenance training in both patrol and detection. Gold Coast has founded innovative canine courses such as canine stress inoculation, prior to deployments, and reality-based detection training. They've also introduced biometrics in the selection and evaluation period in order to increase the likelihood of success. Gold Coast developed a covert detection program for the largest technology company in the world. They also provide detection services to entertainment theme parks, hotels, and special events. When you think Gold Coast Canine, think reliable, experienced, and innovative. Check out goldcoastcanine.com for more information on your next single or dual-purpose canine. Also, check out their course schedule, merchandise, home protectors, and additional services. Follow Gold Coast Canine on all social media platforms. For a 10% discount on merchandise, use the GCK910 discount code.
You know, but a lot of the guys, when you break it down to them in those ways, they're like, you know, we did reward our dogs more, you know, in the academy, you know, or in the train up, or we went to our vendor. and we kind of got away from it once we started deploying, you know, or we just rely on, you know, the e-collar correction to out the dog in training all the time instead of actually teaching the dog to out, right? You know, just things like that. And I feel like there's a lot of things that can be worked on and goal setting that can happen that really, I think there needs to be a revolution in the in-service programs, honestly. You know, like just, you know, making, and this has been a, like an idea I've had for a really long time, but I really feel like, you know, making, you know, like a book or sort of something like that on different types of scenarios available, you know, where they can say, hey, let's pull a scenario out and train it and then learn something about our dog as we do it. And then maybe we realize there's some fundamental skills that we need to go back and drill on, kind of like sport dog people do. You know, like you go to a trial and you see a level 3 scenario and you're like, shit, I never thought of that, right? Mm-hmm. And instead of having to always be reactive as a training group, to be proactive as a training group and start thinking, all right, it's not that I've had a deployment that where my dog sucked, but what can I train? What can we do this week instead of doing the same old stupid shit? 5 cars, 4 hides in detection, lay 1 track, somebody at the end all the time, right? Like, you know, building search with the suspect deep in the building. Same thing with the area search. So the dog has to do some hunting. And like, you know, it's like, all right, we drank a lot of coffee, told a lot of war stories, you know, shit talked to a few people. And then now, you know, we're done with our in-service training. It's the same shit we did last week and the same shit we did the week before, because everybody thinks of it as maintenance, rather than thinking of it as a proactive sort of training that's supposed to prepare us for shit that we don't know we're going to run into down the road. And then we're like, hey, I'm really thankful that I worked on that targeting system, or I'm really thankful I was able to move my dog around or cap him during a search or whatever the case may be, or keep him busy when we're on perimeter, right? Like so many guys tell me, like, when we know there's going to be like a warrant service or something like that, and you know, we're canine guys, we get stuck on the perimeter and my dog is getting bored, you know, and I'm trying to like keep him entertained a little bit while he's on perimeter, you know, and they're asking me, is it okay to just like put my dog on a down and reward him for holding that down? You know, and I'm like, fuck yeah, it's okay to do that. It's okay. It's all right to carry a ball with you, you know, you know, just like you're carrying other tools with you. It's okay to do that stuff, right? It's okay to do that when you're prepping to go on the field, you know, or go on the area search to, you know, bleed off some energy from your dog, to heal him around, to actually train him in context. Yeah, that stuff's okay to do.
No, I think the idea of a book with those sorts of scenarios in it is genius, because I tell you, some of our best training sessions center around failures, something right. That's a failure that has taken place. And outside of those failures, many times I'll have to fully admit that our training is not really innovative and not always fresh in terms of working on things that potentially could happen. I mean, I try to be creative, but I can only be so creative myself, and I kind of have to rely on others as well.
Well, that's where like, and here's the other thing about sport people that, you know, I like to talk about is, when, you know, if I'm in a club with a bunch of other people, which is our, you know, our club in-service training, in, you know, in the hierarchy of a police department or an in-service training, a regional group, you've got hierarchies. Whereas we treat each other in a club, and this is not true of all clubs, because you've been in some Schutzen clubs, I'm sure, you know, where you got a training director and there, it's a German, you know, Schutzen was a German sport for a reason, you know, you know, where, you know, if the training director says it, then so let it be written, so let it be done, right? But like in our PSA group, it's much more of a collaborative thing. Obviously, there are people in the group that are rank beginners, but it's also sometimes interesting to listen to them ask questions or express a curiosity about certain things, because out of that naivete, sometimes you're like, well, shit, I never really thought much about that. But then again, having other people in the group where you can say, you know, like, you know, what are some of the next things to work on? What are some things we haven't thought about yet? Let's do a little brainstorming session. I know there are training groups that do that kind of stuff, that do like some tabletop training where they talk about, you know, some of those things. And I think it's worthwhile to explore that. But I think it's really interesting, you know, to, you know, sort of, in my opinion, take police dogs training to the next step would be like, man, we got to hammer out some of these regional training groups where there's some guys that are running them, dude, that are just, they're in the stone ages. And so you get this really nicely well-trained dog. It's on food reward and stuff. I had a grown man one time from the Midwest. He was like in his 40s coming to pick up like his third patrol dog from us. And, you know, we track our dogs. We don't always put people at the end. We put articles out. Sometimes we'll use food on the track for certain things. And he literally said to me, if I go back to my training group with food on the track or tell them to use food on the track or these articles, they're going to make fun of me. And I'm like, what are you, six? You're worried about your play group making fun of you? But he's like, I won't be able to function, right? Like, everybody will be on me, and they're just trying to hammer me into conformity with how they do things. And that's, that to me is the sad part of it, which is, and that does happen in training groups. It does happen in small groups with hierarchies where it's like, well, this is how we do stuff and just conform, you know? So you go out and you train this really good tracking dog that can problem solve his own negatives and basically function like independently of the handler. And then they go back and they're like, let's just put people at the end of the track every single fucking time until he starts picking his head up and he's racing down the track. And, you know, we turn him into a trailing dog, and he might be a damn good trailing dog, but fuck sakes, man. Like, now you can't compartmentalize anything. You know, every track has to be laid by a person. There always has to be somebody at the end. Like, you know, I was telling the guy I was talking to this afternoon on the Zoom call, I'm like, imagine you went to your in-service training and your trainer said, always put the dope hide on the back license plate of every car. That'll make a really good car searcher, right? That won't teach him to run to the back, I'm sure, right? He'll search all the beginning of the vehicle. He'll search all those nice, you know, areas where, you know, old, you know, productive areas, you know, in the wheel wells and in the door seams. That'll do it, right? But yeah, we do that shit in tracking. Let's put somebody at the end every single fucking time. And let the dog run to the end. And then all of a sudden, our starts go turn to shit. You know, like, the dog is so anticipatory of that, right? And this all comes back to the drive capping thing, right? Which is, why do we set up all of our training to make this classical conditioning sort of leapfrog to where the dog is anticipating this huge reward all the way down the road? Area searches, building searches. I asked him, I said, in your in-service training, when you do a building search, what do the dogs do if they go off leash? They run to the back of the building and search back to you. That's tactically so fucking unsound. I hate it, right? And I'm sorry, here I am, a civilian guy talking about tactics. God forbid. But when I watch that happen, when I have multiple suspects in my building search at a seminar, and now, well, what was the value of the dog running to the back and finding that guy when now we have to encounter all these people with guns out and hands on, where we could have got them out with the dog, or at least alerted us to be able to get them out, and then, you know, taken our time and worked our way down the building systematically. Same thing in area searches, right? Same thing in tracking. And we're as an industry, we're failing our dogs by, you know, we talk a lot about operant conditioning, but then we set up all of our big behaviors as this classical conditioning downslope where every reward is at the very end. And then we wonder why our dogs leak coming into a building search. We wonder why they leak, you know, riding to a call and get so spun up that they're unclear, right? We fail to train obedience because we've convinced ourselves that it's going to make the dog not want to bite for real. Right. And instead of compartmentalizing our training, we turn everything into this classical conditioning cascade of creating all this anticipatory behavior in the dogs. And here we are. Right. So that's kind of like the, you know, the long and the short of all of the, like, I see a lot of stuff in our industry as being, you know, the complaints that handlers have about how their dogs are working or functioning, boiling down to, you know, the sort of the system that we have in place for the upkeep and the maintenance of the dogs, and failing to really challenge a lot of these guys to think, what can I do to make my dog better at navigating all of these deployments and my training? And is my training actually having a positive effect on my deployments, right? Or am I doing myself any favors in my training, right? So I don't get the leaking when I go to the building search, giving our position away when it's a really serious call, and I don't want that to happen, right? So those are a lot of things I've been thinking about recently. And that, to me, they all tie together in a big way, you know, for better or for worse. You know, it makes it so that those of us who think about compartmentalized training still have work into the future, I feel like. But, you know, there are things I would love to change about the system a little bit to, I guess, make it a little bit more predictive of success on the street, you know, especially the training part.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's the same thing we battle here all the time when I talk to especially smaller agencies. You know, they're setting up the same scenario, you know, the same sleeve. Well, Howard and I went to a very large city last year, and, you know, they're using sleeves and runaways, you know, the entire time.
Besides police dogs, Gold Coast Canine sells canine home protectors. Gold Coast Canine trains and develops top-tier home protection dogs that leverage their specialized security and protection training to keep their home and family safe. Each home protection dog is hand-selected and goes through a rigorous screening process prior to training to determine their natural physical and mental aptitudes. This in-depth evaluation ensures they have the ideal temperament and work ethic to create the perfect family companion and home protector. The canine home protectors are thoroughly trained in obedience, agility, barking on command, searching a residence for intruders, and searching, monitoring outdoor perimeters. The canine home protectors are sociable and vigilant. Their concierge service offers regularly scheduled maintenance training, annual refresher, home visits, veterinary care, and board and train while out of town. Gold Coast Canine Home Protector is also well socialized with other dogs, humans, and animals of other species to ensure they are extremely well balanced. You can think of the Gold Coast Canine Home Protectors as family companions with added abilities. Check out goldcoastcanine.com for a full list of training offerings. Also, follow Gold Coast Canine on all social media platforms. Remember to use the GCK910 discount code for 10% off Gold Coast Canine merchandise.
You know how it is, right? Like, because you guys travel, we think we live and die on, you know, on social media, but I run into a lot of cops that have no idea what's going on in the wider world of dog training. Like they don't go on social media. They literally avoid it. They don't know what's out there. Their department doesn't let them go to conferences. You know, they're lucky if every few years they get a chance to go to a seminar, and God knows who's teaching that. Right. So I think, unfortunately, that's part of the problem is that, you know, and that's where, you know, I feel like people like us come into play is like, you know, we're putting stuff out on podcasts, we're doing training, we're doing seminars, things like that, is to bring these ideas and concerns to the wider audience when we get in front of them and challenge them a little bit to think outside the box and to set some goals. I had one canine handler from my last seminar come up to me at the very end, and he's like, he's actually a trainer for one of the agencies. And he came up to me and he said, "You inspired me in this seminar to really start setting more goals for me and my dog going into the future." Mm-hmm. And I'm like, dude, there's nothing anybody could say that makes me happier than hearing that somebody who's been doing this for a number of years in a particular way took something like I've said all week and decided I need to challenge myself more. I need to bite off like some bigger pieces and work on some things, and I can make my dog that much better. And that's to challenge great. Myself every year to be better than I was last year, to be more capable, more deployable, whatever you want to call it, than I was the year before. And to look at, you know, like in my sport, you know, that I do, I closed out my PSA 3 on Raptor when he was 9. He just turned 9. It was a few months later. You know, and so, you know, we won nationals. I closed out his level 3 at nationals, and I retired him after that. But I always tell people, like, he was learning new things up until the day I retired him. And there was still more. If he was physically capable and I wasn't afraid I was going to hurt him by continuing, like, there was more stuff we could learn together. And I mean together, like I'm learning it too. And I feel like if we had more of that attitude, that sport attitude cross over into our training for police dogs, you know, I feel like the dogs would be so much better as they get older. And a lot of them are, a lot of them are, and don't get me wrong, like there are a lot of really good training groups that are out there and they're getting education, they're challenging their teams. The teams, every time they come back for a recertification with us, you see, oh, this dog is, he's cagier, like he's more efficient, like he's better, he's stronger, you know, like all the good stuff is happening. And it's like, these guys are on the right track. I love, you know, there's certain departments I work with where all that stuff happens, right? And it just makes me so fucking proud that they're so much better than the day they left. And then you get those other ones, they come back and you're like, oh my gosh, like what happened in the intervening year? Like this dog
what dog is that?
Yeah, what dog is he, right? He was a tracking machine and, you know, now he's like wandering around like a bumblebee in a windstorm, you know? And it's like, God bless, like, you know, how can we right that ship? And I feel like a lot of the responsibility comes down to, you know, the handlers holding themselves accountable and goal setting, but also like they need to be around, you know, what's that thing that they say, Howard, you know, you are the average of the five people you hang around with most, yeah. Right? So, you know, if you're in a group where everybody's challenging each other with training, like you're going to excel as a canine handler. But if you're in one of those groups where they're doing the things that we talked about earlier, you know, and just like, you know, just like sort of like, what do you want to do? I don't know. What do you want to do? You know, with one of those training groups, then you're going to be the average of all of those handlers. And that's not necessarily where everybody wants to be.
So with social media and all of its evils, there are some good things. But one of the things I think that is particularly good for is kind of keeping your finger on the pulse of what the general understanding is regarding certain things. And there certainly are hard, fast rules, that's in air quotes, that don't get challenged. And I remember getting particularly frustrated, and nobody would know it. There's the beauty of how you really interact with social media. If you do get frustrated, you don't engage. You just move along.
Type out a question where
we've changed the way we do detection. Rather than just simply putting out odors and running problems, we might focus on, I want to get a quicker, better train final response for my dog in this session. Mm-hmm. So one of the things we might do, let's say the dog goes in and he doesn't give the train final response that I'm looking for, which would be a sit or a down or a prop, and he locks up. I actually had published a video, put a video out. And what we started doing is we'll reset. So we'll call the dog back to a heel, send him again. And about 95% of the time, when they go back in the second time, they give the proper train final response. So mm-hmm. I thought that was something that might be useful to some folks. And then, you know, you look at some of the responses, and one of the responses was, and I know I've heard this from all, an old trainer or trainers before, never call your dog off odor.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But why not? Well, I mean, I guess for us, it works.
Mm-hmm. I bet you've done it on a real search and didn't know it.
Right.
Right. So why wouldn't you every now and then try something different?
Yeah. I think there's a lot of that truly where, you know, and when I talk to the younger handlers, I'll tell them, I'm like, you know, you guys are in a position where stuff gets handed down on stone tablets and it's part, some of them are good rules. Some of them are good rules of thumb, but they don't like, as we would say in mathematics, that don't take into account the edge cases, right? Like you're going to have things that don't fall under those, you know, those heuristics, those rules of thumb. And you have to look at those things individually and how you might problem solve those problems. But a lot of people are content to look at things through the lens of, well, you know, in general, here's how I approach things. And so therefore I would never do it this way or would never do it that way. And then obviously that, you know, that makes it so that you don't think outside the box when you're trying to problem solve a little bit. I'm pretty sure there could be some dogs that are so sensitive and their behaviors are so fragile that if you call them off of odor that you might create some problems, right?
For sure.
But if you know your dogs and you know they're robust to the search command. You know, they're robust to, you know, odor and their attraction to odor, right? Then, you know, you can do things in those contexts where you could say, nope, you know, I'm just going to negatively punish here. And, you know, I might start him from a different angle or something like that. So he's not running off of memory and just doing the same thing over again. And my negative punishment is not having any effect, right? So I might give him a little bit of a different look at it, right? But yeah, at the end of the day, you know, you have to experiment a little bit and do things mm-hmm. that are proscribed in order to make any advances in what you're doing, right? I feel like that's...
Yeah, in this particular situation, it would be a situation where we know where the odor is. We recognize the dog's behavior. We know that he's solid on it. Sure. I certainly wouldn't want to call a dog off that is iffy mm-hmm. on the odor. These right. are dogs that they're absolutely, they're in odor and they're just not given the response that we're looking for.
Well sure. Who says the call off has to be a bad thing? You can praise exactly. that.
It's not a punitive thing. It's just a reset. Right. It's just right. calling back to healing.
Well, like yeah. people, you know, like, That's always the funny thing to me is like in a certain context, they'll be like, no, don't ever do that. And then, you know, we'll send him into a building. The dog will alert on a door. We'll down him and then call him back to cover. And nobody's going to say, well, that dog will never find somebody behind a door again, Howard. Like, well, how could you do that? Right. You called him off of human odor. Right. And you're like, I do it all the time. And he's, for some reason, this fucker still wants to go out there and find human odor in the building, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah, so those things fascinate me only because on social media, you get to see so many of those, you know, those things where it's like, you know, I would never do that. Or in this situation, like, that's a terrible idea. Or, you know, it's like you're watching a 30-second clip of something. You know nothing about the dog's backstory, nothing about the training, nothing about what this dog's gone through. Yeah, you feel qualified to comment on it and tell us what a terrible idea it is just because it's outside your ken, right?
So, with no context whatsoever. That's right.
No context, yeah.
Well, that's why it's really not good to respond to videos.
Exactly, right? Like what I always tell my students when they're getting ready to go out is I'm like, don't become the internet police. Right. Mm. Like, you know, like show what you do. That's fine. Like show what you do, you know, like what other people do if you want to. That's fine. But don't get into arguments on social media because all it does is drain your time from what you really want to be doing, which is actually training dogs, which I think some people that are on social media 24 hours a day are literally like, how do you have enough time to train dogs to gain the experience to make all the commentary?
You're not training dogs.
Exactly.
Well, before we wrap things up, I wanted to mention a dog. We got a dog from you a number of years ago, a special dog. You know, we've talked about it before. I had a handler that was shot and killed. And
yes,
he actually, it was one of those weird situations where I didn't go select the dog. I was teaching. I felt like I couldn't get away from school. And Tim was getting his second dog, and he went to your place. And actually, the first dog he selected, we brought back, but it was just he had a weird quirk. It was something he didn't want to go through doorways. Mm-hmm. And even when we tried to entice him, but you know that kind of stuff happens. But second dog was young. The spelling of his name is CIKO, which mm-hmm. most people would look at that and say Seiko probably.
Right.
Tim said, "Oh, that's Psycho" in his in his Georgia accent. So right. Psycho stuck, except for when he went to court. But everybody knew the dog is Psycho. And when Tim passed, he ended up living with my wife and I for his last
remember that.
3 or so years. And what a cool dog. And he was a real testament to Tim's work ethic. Mm-hmm. And Rich remembers Tim and Psycho from seminars. And
sure.
They were quite a force. They had a lot of success. The dog was simply a robot. What an amazing dog. And it was really fun having him here. I know my wife misses him greatly because he became quite a force here as well. And those two were thick as thieves, mm-hmm. but cool dog.
I do remember when that happened. It was a shock for everybody involved and, mm-hmm. For sure a horrible experience, but, yeah, he was, I do remember many times you commenting on how that dog performed not only when he was in training, but on the street and then when he came home to you, I'm sure it was a, you know, nothing can ever, you know, solve the sort of situation when it comes down. But, you know, I'm sure a piece of Tim was living on for you in that song when he was with you. And, you know, that's a great testament to Tim.
Yeah. Well, Jerry, I really appreciate you coming on the episode. I think there's so many good takeaways that people are going to, I know I'll get feedback that they're going to say, I have to listen to this one more than once, which that's a good thing.
Absolutely a good thing.
Well, I appreciate you having me on. It was a pleasure. It's always a pleasure when I run into you at conferences. I do know that we're going to probably both be at the Hold the Line conference.
All of us.
Yeah. We'll be there, and I'll be ironically doing a class on drive capping there. So I did want to mention that.
Obedience. Is that okay?
What's that?
Obedience, right? Yellow obedience.
You know, when you got to have a fancier name to get people to show up at your section, right? So
you do.
But yeah, I didn't want to mention that since we're all going to be there, and I know you're a supporter of that conference. And so shout out to Joe and his group for coming down to save us some travel time to the conference. That's welcome this year for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah. Rich and I are going to be speaking as well. We've got one slot, but looking forward to it. It's going to be a little bit different than the one we've done before. So.
Nice.
Well, super. Well, thanks for having me on. And anytime, I'd always be happy to join you. I always enjoy talking with you guys and you, Howard. You know, like I said, we've always run into each other all the time, and we always have good conversations. And so it's always nicer to meet in person than it is over the airwaves. But I'll take this until I get to see you in April.
All right. Very good.
Yeah, I look forward to meeting you there too as well.
Thanks, Rich.
All right. Thank you very much.
Well, my friend Howard, that was a great episode, full of information. He has a big dog IQ.
For sure. Yeah. He definitely has done a lot. When I say he's jumped in with both feet, I mean he's jumped in with both feet.
Very smart guy. You can tell his education did not go to waste, even though he might not have finished his PhD.
Yeah, for sure.
He definitely got one in dogs.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd say so.
Well, what are we sampling tonight, sir?
I believe Buffalo Trace. I know we've done it before, but how do you not keep going back to it?
Well, you know, Buffalo Trace, if you're looking at the bottle itself, with a $35, you know, $38 bottle of bourbon, it is probably one of the best bottles of bourbon you can have in your bar. So if you don't have Buffalo Trace, you should get it.
It's highly sought after still. I mean, it is, like, if it shows up on the shelf here in North Carolina, it's gone.
Man, it is delicious.
Yep.
All right, my friend. Well, here's to the hair of the dog that bit you. It's good to see you.
Good to see you.
Thanks so much, you guys, for following along, supporting us, and listening to these wonderful conversations that Howard and I are just blessed to have each and every day. We'd like to thank and support all of our first responders, police, fire, EMS, and our military for once again holding the line, keeping us safe. Stay safe, brothers and sisters. We love you. God bless, and God bless America.